Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war is arguably now increasingly one being waged against us, and indeed the free world, by communist China. It has taken economic warfare against us and our interests to new levels. It has been using the fruits of its economic warfare against us to build up its military capacity, and it is increasingly making no secret of its ambitions to supplant the United States as the world's dominant power. To talk about all of that, and most especially his area of specialization, which is what are the strategic implications of what China is up to, especially in the military space, I'm delighted to say, is Richard Fisher. He is the senior fellow responsible for Asian military affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center, the president of Pacific Strategies, Inc., the author of numerous important books and countless articles. His most recent book is China's Military Modernization, Building for Regional and Global Reach. I am thrilled that we have, as we occasionally do, a full hour of Rick's time to really drill down on what the Chinese are up to and what it means for all of us. And so join me in welcoming Rick Fisher back to our microphones. Rick, it's so good to have you. Welcome.
Frank, thanks for having me back.
Well, you not only participated in, but I gather made a presentation at an event that I was very keen to start with, Rick. It was put on by the 2049 Institute. This is an organization that's probably not terribly well known outside of the circles like yours that follow China closely, but it's highly regarded, I believe, as a resource, as are you, for insights about what the Chinese are doing. And the subject, as I understand it, was the nightmare scenario, which is to say, what China may have in store for the Republic of China on Taiwan. Tell us a little bit about both the program and some of the most important insights that you and others there wanted the audience to take away.
Well, Frank, you're quite right. Project 2049 is a highly regarded organization, and some of its analysts, like Ian Easton and Mark Stokes, are very highly regarded experts on Chinese military developments and also Taiwanese military developments. The program held on Halloween was an examination of the nightmare scenario of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. The nightmare scenario, as I presented, includes an assessment that the Chinese largely have the capabilities needed to invade Taiwan. They simply have to tie some ends together, like perfecting their new joint forces strategies, and then wait for a lot of luck. Crossing the Taiwan Strait in essentially a reverse Dunkirk-like invasion, which is what it would be, because the Chinese would be relying on thousands of platforms like civilian airliners or civilian barges that are now on China's rivers. The Chinese would also require a fantastic amount of luck, perfect weather, adequate surprise, flawless execution, capturing of many airfields and ports. But if they can do that, the Chinese do have the capacity to, in a month, put over 5 million people on that island. And having done that, the United States then faces a very terrible decision, because it'll take a lot of time for the Americans and whatever allies we can count on to gather for a reinvasion, and 5 million troops and support personnel and occupation personnel is a very daunting obstacle to overcome to retake Taiwan and give freedom back to those people who currently are free today.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple of the particulars there, Rick, because that's an extraordinary statement. 5 million people deployed in the space of a month. How many Taiwanese, or people of the Republic of China, if you will, on Taiwan are there? And the Chinese have obviously been giving a lot of thought to this. They've been planning and preparing for this kind of scenario, obviously, for some time. What would they expect to have to do with the people on the island in order to maintain, you know, a defensive position against any kind of effort to retake it?
Well, Frank, you're absolutely right. The Chinese have been scheming, planning for this since they took power in 1949. They came close to an invasion in 1950, but Mao was convinced by Stalin to invade Korea instead. But in the last 20 years, the preparations to invade Taiwan have been accelerated. And we may be facing such a nightmare scenario as early as 2020, or perhaps by the mid-2020s, not very, very far away. But the critical number, Frank, is there are 8.6 million families on Taiwan. Right now, we're witnessing China sending 1 million bureaucrats and other minor officials to Xinjiang to put one Han Chinese in each of the families in Xinjiang. So the ability to put 5 million, or maybe the number is larger, because I'm not really counting military airfields as well. What if China is able to put 8 million Chinese, Han Chinese, on Taiwan in the space of a month? Not only will it have so many troops, but it will be able to occupy the island in a very intimate manner. So it's not just a matter of conquering Taiwan's military forces, destroying Taiwan's military forces, its formal military capacity to resist, but it's also a matter of basically tying down every family on the island and making it clear, if you resist, we have enough people to come and take out your whole family.
So you're saying, Rick Fisher, in Xinjiang right now, there's a kind of dress rehearsal for an occupation force penetrating and essentially suppressing any kind of resistance, quite apart from what the military forces might be able and willing to do. It's going to essentially have this kind of, well, I guess, people's force at work, ensuring that anyone who is inclined to resist is discouraged, for sure, and monitored and ratted out the very minimum.
Every day, you're going to get your daily dose of agitprop, and eventually you'll learn how to be a slave of the Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, scary. Rick, we have to pause for a moment. We'll be right back with Richard Fisher right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting with the Senior Fellow for Asian Military Affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. His name is Rick Fisher. We talked a little bit about Taiwan in the first segment, specifically an analysis that he and others have done for the Project 2049 Institute concerning the nightmare that Taiwan could be taken very rapidly and held by Communist China within a month's time, and essentially no notice, certainly if not today, in the very near future. Rick, this is one of the things, of course, that is now beginning to confront the Trump administration, and it is beginning to push back, at least at the rhetorical level and with, I guess, shows of force, if you will, freedom of navigation exercises and the like. Talk a little bit about what our friend John Bolton, the National Security Advisor to the President, has been saying about the United States' intent to maintain free passage in the South China Sea, and how our so-called allies in the region are beginning to align themselves in what seems increasingly a choice between the United States on the one hand and China on the other.
Yes, Frank. China is taking the next step in its goal of locking off the South China Sea, making sure that not just American, but the military forces of any other country are not allowed into the South China Sea, and that by doing so, it can force the countries of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations into essentially recognizing China's sovereignty over the region, really, and gradually, if not immediately, ending their military relationships with outside countries like the United States. The cutting edge of China's effort right now is diplomatic. After having built up seven new island bases that really didn't exist 2 years ago, China is now reviving an ASEAN goal of 20 years now to set up a code of conduct, a set of rules that applies to everybody in making sure that that the territorial disputes in the South China Sea don't lead to war. Now, that China has taken that very laudable goal and turned it on its head and turned the code of conduct into a weapon that China can use then to divide the ASEAN states from their traditional longstanding political and strategic friends in the West, including the United States, Australia, Japan, and other countries, India. A code of conduct draft that is reportedly circulating would stipulate that no outside country could enter into military exercises with the members of ASEAN without the approval of all the other member states. And this is China's attempt, essentially, to exclude the United States from military exercises with its defense treaty ally, the Philippines, or with its close strategic partners, Singapore, and sometimes Malaysia. Malaysia has a very close military relationship with Australia, traditional longstanding relationship. And there are other relationships, especially India's relationship with Vietnam, for example. All of these previously served to create a web of relationships that deterred aggressors, especially China. But China is trying to sweep away this web, in part, with this new code of conduct. And to his credit, John Bolton, on the sidelines, speaking on the sidelines of the latest Association of Southeast Asian Nations conference about 2 days ago, objected to all this and stated clearly that the United States would, quote, oppose any agreements between China and other claimants in the South China Sea that limit free passage to international shipping, and that American naval vessels would continue to sail through those waters, unquote. Great, great news, great statement, a great assertion of American interests by our National Security Advisor.
And where does that leave us, Rick, as you see it? We've talked, you and I and many others on this program in recent months, about the so-called Belt and Road Initiative that China is using to extend its hegemony over much of the landmass of Eurasia. I was interested to see recently that they have begun trying to cultivate, at least with the Philippines, and I assume with others as well, commercial ties for the exploitation of some of the mineral and other resources of the South China Sea, that would seemingly try to create a similar kind of web, if you will, of dependencies and influence for the Chinese at our expense. How do you see this sorting, especially with a fellow like Duterte, who's been rather problematic as the president of the Philippines?
Well, Frank, really, since the United States ended its military bases relationship with the Philippines in 1991, 1992, China has set as its first goal the wholesale purchase of the political elites of Southeast Asia. And it has largely accomplished this goal. Purchasing of elites, meaning great investment deals that wrap up generations of political leaders and essentially make it impossible for any new leader to come along and oppose China's goals. And these goals then eventually move from economic to political to military. And right now we're seeing the beginning of the military phase of China's consolidation of control over this region. Now, the United States has come along very late. During the Obama administration, United States basically did nothing to oppose this. And at a minimum, John Bolton and President Trump understand that we have a real problem. But again, we're really not in a place where we're fighting back. I mean, if we were fighting back, we would be supplying hundreds of short-range ballistic missiles to the Philippines, regardless of a nutcase like Duterte, who is essentially a cultural communist, but is also the president of a democracy, as it is. We would be leading a very sophisticated information campaign to demonize the Chinese, and we would be pushing weapon sales and military cooperation schemes to deter the Chinese to an even greater degree than we're doing now.
Well, in other words, we would be doing to them pretty much what they're doing to us through these same nations, in this case, those being for many years allied with us. This brings me to another meeting that took place last week, Rick Fisher, as I understand it, the so-called diplomatic and security dialogue between the United States, represented by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Secretary of Defense James Mattis, and I guess roughly counterparts to them in the Chinese leadership. It's been described as a kind of dialogue of the deaf. What happened there, and what was, as you saw it, the takeaway from the conversation?
These dialogues were an invention of the George W. Bush administration, and were embraced very strongly by the Obama administration, essentially as a pro forma way to register American concerns with Chinese actions while committing basically not to do anything about them and to continue the so-called win-win economic and strategic relationship that is at least making some sectors of both countries very wealthy. Now, it is clear that under the Trump administration, a different kind of consensus about China has been developing from the beginning of his administration.
And when you say consensus, Rick, just to calibrate that, it seems as though it's on both sides of the aisle, at least it has to this point. Is that correct?
Yes, there is great concern on the Democratic side of the aisle as there is on the Republican side. Both sides get to listen to the same classified briefings and read the same classified and unclassified reports, and it's simply undeniable. China, as you stated in the opening, Frank, is seeking to displace the United States from its global power position and to rewrite the rules of global relationships to benefit the dictatorship of the Chinese Communist Party. And at least in some areas more than others, the Trump administration is very aware of this and is beginning to organize the resistance, to draw the lines, to properly understand so it can describe what China is doing, and then to begin to describe this and to other countries to by way of trying to organize them to join the resistance.
And as a result, these dialogues then would be pretty much simply going through the motions of having meetings with and exchanges among the leaders of the two nations. But in the meantime, the game really is with third parties and more of a strategic competition, at the very least, if not a Cold War.
Of course, I don't sit in on these meetings, but I imagine that under the Trump administration, they have become much more sharper and blunter than they were under the Obama administration. But I think the same MO holds. Both sides come to town, smile each other, raise their wine glasses, and then proceed to try to cut each other down, portraying the other side as the aggressor and the threat. But at the end of the meeting, okay, we finished saying our piece. We can go home now and build more weapons.
That certainly seems to be true of the Chinese, and that's what we're going to talk about with Rick Fisher following a short break right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. Richard Fisher, one of our country's great authorities on what Communist China is doing in terms of building its capacity to supplant the United States as the preeminent power in the world, and indeed to call the shots worldwide, increasingly at our expense, not just in the economic sense, but quite possibly in the sense of, well, who knows, even the survival of our republic. Rick is the senior fellow at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He is the author of China's Military Modernization, among countless articles and essays. He is also, I'm very pleased to say, a regular contributor to our program here at Secure Freedom Radio, and is generous with his time today for this full hour of conversation. And Rick, your specialty, and really it is world class, you have followed and monitored and chronicled what the Chinese are doing to build up their military capabilities in every domain. And I'd like to just walk through with our audience some of the most important of these developments, starting since we've been talking about the South China Sea, we've been talking about Taiwan, the naval aspects, both in terms of their own navy and what they've been doing to develop the capacity to neutralize ours in the far-flung reaches of the Western Pacific.
Frank, unrestrained by the 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that we signed with the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, China has built and deployed one of the most impressive arsenals of medium and intermediate range missiles that not only deliver nuclear warheads, but also deliver maneuverable hypersonic warheads that are precision guided and designed to take out large naval ships like American aircraft carriers, logistic support ships, and amphibious assault ships. These missiles are deployed. The most recent, the Dongfeng 26, has the range to reach Guam from Chinese territory, from land bases. But in assembling not only anti-ship ballistic missiles, but aircraft with long-range anti-ship cruise missiles and scores of new submarines to take out the American Navy, China is also preparing to replace the American Navy with a very larger, perhaps an even larger power projection naval fleet than the United States has today. China could have up to 6 aircraft carriers by the end of the 2020s. And by that point, it will be building nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. I wouldn't be surprised if the Chinese would invest in a fleet of 15 to 20 aircraft carriers by 2050.
And that would compare to ours of about 11, as I recall now.
Right, right. And China will have the escort ships, the submarines, and also nuclear-powered logistic support ships. So China will have the first all-nuclear-powered a carrier battle group. And so these can sail around the world at very high speed, restrained only by really the amount of fuel and food that they can carry along, and will be enforcing Chinese interests that will be organized as they are right now, today, into a set of global proto-alliances that will cover most of Central Asia and reach into Europe, all of Africa. And right now, the cutting edge is building proto-alliances that will encompass all of Latin America. So China will have the military relationships to exclude the United States and the military forces to do so by well before the middle of this century.
And again, Rick Fisher, this is by design. This is not an accident, and that design has been a long time a building. We used to hear happy talk about first of all, that there wasn't going to be any threat from China. It was going to be turned into another, responsible world power, part of the global economy, certainly not a threat. The peaceful rise of China, I think, sort of became the way of characterizing all of that. That seems now pretty much off the board. What we're looking at is a rise of China that is, if not at the moment, a threat and hostile in intent, certainly will be in the not-too-distant future. And what you, again, I think are unsurpassed at, Rick Fisher, is helping do the proverbial dot connecting between the military capabilities at sea and, in space and in the air and in the cyber domain and on the land, and how these all fit in to the acquisition of strategic bases and other assets to control choke points and project power. It's really quite stunning. I'm not sure the world has ever seen anything quite like it. Certainly, in terms of the brief time it's taken for the Chinese to go from, this mass impoverished population to a first world superpower. And Rick, before we leave the sea-based piece of this, I did just want to touch on something that caught my attention. Our friend Bill Gertz wrote about recently in the Washington Free Beacon about the so-called phantom underwater drone warfare capabilities that are now being assembled by the Chinese again to threaten our carrier battle groups and exercise control of the South China and perhaps other waters as well.
China's unmanned technology sector is probably the world's largest and most innovative today. China's investment in unmanned underwater vehicles, UUVs, is also tremendous. And the Chinese have plans to build a variety of UUVs. They displayed a model of a kind of large UUV at the most recent Zhuhai Air Show last week. But the UUVs initially will probably serve as kind of mobile mine beds, and they will be linked to seabed sensors that will be placed over wide areas, starting in the East China Sea, around Taiwan, and then into the South China Sea. All of this to make the seas light up so that enemy submarines can be seen, and instead of sending ships full of men, send these unmanned systems, unmanned underwater vessels or unmanned surface vessels, which China is building just as rapidly, to swarm around the American or Japanese submarine and then sink it.
And this, to come back to Taiwan for just a moment, is a means by which attacks can be mounted 360 degrees around the island. So it can for sure interfere with any efforts we might make to reinforce the Taiwanese or to liberate the island if it should be taken. And is again a part of this nightmare scenario that you were talking about earlier, Rick Fisher. Rick, quickly, I always think it's important for us to highlight one of the other pieces of what the Chinese are up to that is breathtaking, really, in its ambition, and that is in space. We've had a senior Chinese military officer make very explicit China's intentions in this domain. Talk a little bit about that and what they're doing to operationalize their ambitions.
Yes, Frank. Within about 3 days ago, a deputy commander of the Chinese Air Force was quoted in the Chinese media, basically stating that China's ambition to create an aerospace force is well underway. By this, what we're looking at is a future in which the People's Liberation Army Air Force, the People's Liberation Army Rocket Force, and the new PLA Strategic Support Force will all come together in jointly to take control of low Earth orbit, to take control of the moon, take control of the Lagrangian points, equidistant equal gravitational points in the Earth-Moon system, that will all allow China to take control of the Earth-Moon system. You have entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos who are investing in new inexpensive space launch capabilities, trying to create what they call the space economy. And all that's well and good, and Trump supports this. But the Chinese are out there right now investing in the toll booth. They are investing in the means to make sure that they have a veto over anything we may do on the moon and beyond the moon.
Oh. Rick, this is somewhat reminiscent of the Barbary Pirates, a phenomenon that was the sort of first foreign war of the United States early on in the nation's history. People controlling access, in that case, to the Mediterranean, to the east, for that matter. One of the reasons we're told that Columbus sailed west was to avoid the control that was being exercised by the pirates there and others. When you look at what the Chinese could do with control of space, Rick, could you just succinctly summarize what it means if it's not just tolls that they're exacting, but essentially exercising vetoes, or worse yet, using space as a platform from which to attack its terrestrial enemies, notably us?
Well, yes, the ability to control low Earth orbit, medium Earth orbits, essentially would allow China to dominate all military operations on Earth. If the United States cannot have access to space-based communication, surveillance, early warning assets, then we're defeated. We can't win. Then the Chinese impose their political cost. Not just in the United States, but the rest of the world as well.
Rick Fisher, we have to pause for one last break. We'll be right back concluding this very special hour-long conversation with one of the country's great experts on China and the threat that it poses to us today and in the future, Richard Fisher, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final installment of this remarkable conversation with Rick Fisher about what turns out to be not just one nightmare scenario, but quite a number involving communist China and its ambitions and the extent to which they are very much at odds with our interests and perhaps even our survival as a nation. Rick, you have been writing about and thinking about so many of these topics for so long that I want to extend beyond the subject of your terrific book, China's Military Modernization, to just pick up a couple of other issues. I've read recently that the Chinese are setting up a base in Antarctica, and along with their interest in laying claim to some of the Arctic's resources, again, simply reinforces the point that, as you say, these guys are on the march truly all over the globe. Are there particular reasons to be concerned about the strategic implications of what China may be doing in these polar regions?
Well, one of the direct benefits for having a base in Antarctica is that the polar regions tend to be the areas of the Earth where polar orbit satellites pass the closest to the Earth. So most of our reconnaissance satellites are polar orbit satellites, and as well those from other countries too. So having space and buildings in Antarctica allows you to conceal a number of high-fidelity observation systems to be able to track and target these satellites. That's just one benefit. You get to keep track of what everybody else is doing as well. The Chinese are creating a presence in Antarctica and want to create a presence in the Arctic. They think they have claims to that area as well, in part for strategic military, direct strategic military reasons.
Rick, another dot that I'd like to help connect for our audience involves a friendly nation, in fact, one of our most important allies, the United Kingdom. And I have seen an article to the effect that the Brits have, to my astonishment, extended some kind of unlimited license for the sale of sophisticated military technology from Britain to communist China. Have you seen this, and what do you make of it? First of all, is it true as far as you can tell, and why would they do that?
Well, I certainly can't confirm the story. I've read it, and it is extremely disturbing, of course, but it's also consistent with what the British have been doing. The British, during the 1990s, were among the countries that went up right up to the limit of the European Union military embargo against China. During the 1990s, the British sold airborne radar to the Chinese, and some of that airborne radar is now being used by Chinese Navy surveillance aircraft, long-range surveillance aircraft that can help to target long-range anti-ship cruise missiles. So the British, sadly, have a history of sharing this kind of technology with China in the full knowledge that anything they sell the Chinese is going to benefit the People's Liberation Army eventually. It's really incumbent upon the United States to complain loudly, but also to understand that our British friends are under real pressure with leaving the European Union. They're going to have to find new markets for their military products, and this is an early step in that direction. It's the wrong direction, and it's up to the United States to make this clear to our friends in London.
It's just stunningly short-sighted, though, because it is a certainty that in due course, if not in the very near future, Britain, like the rest of the free world, will be suffering at the hands of probably some of the technology they're making available to the Chinese. Rick, one other thing that I have been reporting on here from the vantage point of many who are far more expert than I about these things is a contest that is now underway in a new domain, I guess you might call it, and that is what's known as 5G. I don't know how much you're aware of the technology. I'm frankly not, but we know something about the companies that are trying to essentially make theirs the standard worldwide, and they're Chinese, and they are very far advanced, it sounds like, and I just wonder what your sense is of the implications for our national security as well as our economy if we wind up depending on a Chinese-dominated 5G network.
Well, Frank, if you really don't understand 5G, you could probably get a nice lecture about it from your kid or your grandkid, because this is the next generation of technology that will control their all-important cell phone. And 5G promises all kinds of capability enhancements beyond 4G, the current level of technology. And sadly, Chinese companies have been pioneers in bringing 5G to the market faster than other companies, American, Japanese, other companies. And they are quickly gaining contracts around the world to help countries advance from 4G to 5G. And this is an absolute danger. China built and wired the new headquarters of the African Union about 5 years ago.
wired in every sense of the word, you can be sure.
Wired in every sense of the word. That building is completely has complete Chinese electronics, all the comms. Well, about a year ago, members of the African Union discovered that everything they say or do online is being piped to China because of this.
Like Hillary Clinton's emails.
Yes, yes.
In real time.
Everything. So this is the real danger. I mean, very clearly, I mean, with no exaggeration, if you allow a Chinese 5G company to build your network, basically you are surrendering all the information that passes over that network to China, and they will exploit it. They will put it all in massive databases, and they will parse it out and come after you if they have to, block you if they have to, steal your technology if they want to, on and on.
Let me close this out, Rick, and again, I'm so grateful to you for the time you give us and the extraordinary research and analysis that you put into not only our conversations but all the work you do. I wanted to call your attention to something that I've just learned about that, again, is probably a little outside of your normal day-to-day work, but is a further aspect of the comprehensive assault on our economy, yes, but also our strategic interests and indeed the health of our people, namely something that a woman by the name of Rosemary Gibson has just put out a new book about entitled China RX, that is about basically the dangers of America's reliance on Chinese supply lines for pharmaceuticals and other medicines. Rick, you've studied what they're doing in things like rare earth minerals and microprocessors and chips and so many other kinds of technologies. But could you just wrap your head around and very briefly explain to the rest of us what the strategic stakes might be if our antibiotics, including the entire supply of penicillin and vitamin C and other therapeutic medicines are dependent upon them providing them to us?
Well, Frank, I've not read Ms. Gibson's book, but I think what she is warning us about is China's taking over of an economic sector, much as it has been able to take over so many other economic sectors. You mentioned rare earth minerals. You look at the hollowing out of the American manufacturing capability over the last 20 years. We don't build the steel we need. We don't make the plastics that we need. So many others. But medicine seems to be yet the latest realization of a Chinese dominance that we've basically sold to ourselves on the expectation of lower prices and a less regulated manufacturing environment to enable those prices to be depressed even more. We have to make a choice. We're going to have our own medicines, or we're going to be vulnerable to China.
Yeah, in so many ways. Rick Fisher, I appreciate the work you do, my friend, at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. Come back to us again soon, Rick, if you will. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.